Breach, written by Matthew Moses Acosta, narrated by 11 Labs Adam. Chapter 1. William Orson. In the mirror he saw himself, but could not admit it, could not match the face with the person. His hand traced the reflection before him. Thick, dark, short hair, in the standard style, neatly trimmed along the sides, slightly longer on top and slicked back. Clean-shaven, sharp jawline, chestnut honey-tinted brown eyes, nearly obscured by his pupils. He stared straight into those dark pits, questioningly attempting to connect. He was searching for something, but what exactly? He was not sure. The man in the reflection was him, but it wasn't two. The face looking back was alien and unidentifiable. Staring blankly ahead, he found himself suddenly overcome with vertigo. It took all he could give to stay upright. He gripped the sink, steadying his balance and breathing fast as his teeth clenched shut. An immense pressure began to throb in his skull in tandem with an ever-loudening, ear-piercing ring. The sun shone through the blinds and cast its rays upon his eyes. An alarm blared and he woke up with a jolt. He laid in bed for a few moments, taking shallow breaths and letting the tension from his dream dissipate. He looked around the room to regain his bearings. Brown walls. Check. Grey sheets. Dresser, closet, desk, chair, bookcase, hands still organic. And my own... I'm not crazy yet, he thought to himself, smiling. A cool calmness radiated through his body as he exhaled. He had a job to do. It was time to wake up. He rose slowly, letting his feet dangle off the bed, gingerly touching the cold wood floor. As he stood, he began to stretch and yawn. Then promptly set to his morning routine. To him, there was something about it, something grounding and calming in the methodical cycle he worked through. He repeated the steps in his head as he went, shut off alarm, get out of bed, shower, brush teeth, and floss, get dressed, make bed, feed Josie, make breakfast. Finally, sitting down to eat, he took a brief moment to appreciate the layout of his surroundings. An upscale downtown apartment with all the proper trappings for a person of his distinction. He resided in a two-floor luxury condo with no expense spared, a space where even practicality was forced to take a back seat. The direct center of the apartment was reserved exclusively for an iron spiral staircase connecting both floors, several rooms and hallways, radiated off from this central piece. Stylistically, the apartment carried a powerful sense of poise, deftly melding feelings of warmth and coziness through glossy wooden floors, earth-tone walls, and warm dim light. However, it also displayed a certain ferocity and cold efficiency. Visitors entering from the elevator were immediately corralled into the entrance hall and forced to confront the spiral staircase. Just behind it, a rock wall infinity fountain on the far wall, spanning both floors, forcing perspective for how much space the apartment occupied. It remained cozy yet free, an immaculate open space sprinkled with chic furniture. He had it all, a multimedia hologram interface in the living room, an all-natural enclosed terrace garden outside the kitchen door, an omni-stove with the ability to acquire any food at the touch of a button elegantly placed in the center of his wide style island kitchen, a personal paper library and lab bench for at-home diagnostic work, multiple guest rooms, a common area, even a small gym. And of course, every room came equipped with a wall-mounted virtual assistant, or VA. He'd done well for himself. Yet he couldn't help wanting more. More of what he wasn't sure, but what he was sure of was that what he saw didn't feel like a complete set. It was lacking a critical component to bring it all together, some keystone which eternally evaded him. Then, his eyes fixed on the bird in its cage in the corner of the kitchen, he took a catalogue of Joase, a goldfinch, quite small and delicate, but with beautiful colours, vibrant yellow with a gentle fade into grey. Simple, yet majestic. He thought for a moment how strange it was that one small bird could beat his apartment when it came to beauty. A low trill vibrated in his ears. He glanced up at the clock. It was time. He headed to the Numo to get to work. He chuckled to himself as he thought, "Work. As if I could really call it that." He felt that to label it work implied it was undesirable, something that would get done eventually, albeit begrudgingly. He thought of his work more as a responsibility and a happy one at that, despite the self-proclaimed dissatisfaction amongst his peers regarding the doldrums of work and life. He somehow managed to stay excited to see those admitted to his ward. In his mind, no matter how similar aspects of them were, they all had subtle differences, unique traits, personal stories which made each and every one of them worth it. He exited through the back entrance of his apartment into a small broom closet lined with pristine white tile and illuminated overhead by fluorescent bulbs. In the direct center of the room was a metal circle pad, large enough for him to stand on comfortably. "Casper, bring up the Numo," he called out to the VA. A bright shining cylinder rose from the metal pad on the floor, a door slid open, and he entered. The Numo transportation system, a tube within a tube equipped with a seat, seatbelt, and start button in the innermost cylinder. A trip consisting of no more than a few seconds in the frictionless pipe system could get him just about anywhere. However, the nausea always tugged at his stomach. He climbed in, the mechanism activated, and within seconds he felt an incredible burst of speed and pressure knocking all the air from his lungs. Before he knew it, the Numo was stopped and a hatch opened above him. The opened hatch showered him in a small circular area of light. He crawled out of the top, as usual, into another small closet, then proceeded with climbing up the ladder directly in front of him and through a second overhead hatch, opening up into yet another small room with a single door. He opened it, and towering over him lay tightly sealed, massive steel doors with the words Fortitude, Enterprise, Solidarity engraved in large, powerful letters. Next to the door on the left was a glowing control panel. He punched in a quick code and swiped his ID in the card reader. "Welcome, William Orson." The panel crackled in monotone. The massive doors before him slowly screeched open to the second screening. He pressed on, entering a slightly larger, harshly lit, all-white, sterile room, which was barren of any distinguishing features, save for a long rectangular window about 10 feet above his head on the right. The doors behind him shut tight and decompressed. Inside the window, he could see various security personnel at work on the monitors in front of them, no doubt running DNA scans and initializing the decontamination process. A white steam rose through the floor as usual, while lasers of various colors crisscrossed and rose all over his body. "And next comes the water and bacteria scrub," he grumbled to himself, silently. "You know, maybe just this once they'll have the courtesy to actually what..." Cold antibacterial gel was dumped unceremoniously all over, saturating him through his clothes to the bone, from head to toe. After 2 minutes of soaked shivering, a red light came on, and the room erupted into a wind tunnel of hot, drying air, alleviating him from his cold torment within seconds. Dry again and cleared to proceed, the metal doors directly ahead of him slid open, and he continued along his way down a poorly lit cinder block hallway to the equipment room. Rounding a corner, he ran straight into a colleague, Dr. Opim. "Good morning, William. How's it going?" she asked casually, waving a hand. "You can call me Will Doc, but, eh? You know the same old grime. That decon process gets me every damn time," whined Will. Yeah, I feel you, buddy, but hey, it's all about what's best for the patients and the hospital. Remember solidarity," Opim chirped. It took all Will had to not roll his eyes at the utterance of this classic nationalist maxim. I know, but come on, you know this place could spring for a heater on that antibacterial gel," he retorted. "Not true. It's a luxury, and you know our nation needs everyone to buckle down in this time of need. Ugh, not again with that nationalist crap, Opim. You know they have the money. We've all attended those budget meetings. Besides, if my immune system is compromised by the cold and I catch some kind of disease, then this nation is out one damn good augmek. He griped. Will knew it was a total bluff, not that catching a disease was impossible, but with all of the immunizations, sterilizing, and bio-T cell augmentation over the years, most common diseases had been virtually eradicated. It wasn't really the cold gel that bothered Will at all, but rather his perception of the willingness of his colleague to blindly allow their thought patterns to be so easily hijacked by nationalist sloganeering. That, and he was caught off guard and hadn't fully committed to his workplace mask yet this morning. Will snapped out of his self-absorption for a moment and read Opim's face. He noticed that she suddenly looked disgruntled. He knew that look. Everyone put that same exact look on if you said anything even remotely derogatory about the nation. It held a tinge of fear, which was unsettling to see on such a prominent woman. She was tall, imposing, and equipped with a soft yet assertive face. This look of disgruntlement didn't suit her. It was uncommon for administrators of her stature to display such physical tells to their thoughts. "I'll see you upstairs," she stated laconically as she walked off. Opim continued down the hallway, round a corner, and she was gone. Will sighed and shrugged, turning to resume his journey, and within a few seconds of walking, was face to face with the equipment room door. As usual, there lay yet another interface. Between him and where he wanted to be, he keyed up his ID sequence and was in. This room was small, but had an intimate, sheltered feel. It had no overhead lights, and its four tightly spaced aisles were illuminated by the blue glow of various computer monitors and a faint red glimmer which shone from under assorted wrist kits in each of the aisles. Will felt at peace as he turned his forearm over to look at his caste symbol, the staff of Asclepius, the image of a serpent coiled around a staff, the symbol of a healer. How long ago was it that I got this? I had to be at least 6 years old. Will struggled to remember what life was like when he was younger. He wasn't entirely sure that he was born in the state education center. However, all of his first memories did hail from there. He recalled tests, piles of them always, and reading, skill set practices, mandatory socialization with peers. Socialization. He chuckled. An activity advertised as recreation, and still then, they were being evaluated. There were always educators, abound, clipboard handy, smiling ear to ear, ready to dispense wisdom and knowledge at a moment's notice. The vivid memory of the educators sent a chill down his spine, and the dull, creeping pain of an injury long forgotten began radiating from his forearm. He could taste the pain of assignment day when he was first joined together with his symbol as if it were happening to him all over again. He was in a room with countless other children. They were all sitting together in a dining hall, eating small snacks and waiting in silence, save for the whispers between them. There was a speaker at the head of the room, clad in a fierce and tightly groomed suit, who was reading off of an electronic tablet. Names were announced, children got up, and an educator led them out of the room. Will spent hours in that room, apprehensively waiting. It took all he could not to scream with anticipation. A flash of his friend Alan leapt into memory. "Now, that was the right type of person," Will remarked with a smile to himself. Alan was his first true friend in the education center, and today, on the hour of assignment, he was as faithful as ever. Alan put a hand on Will's shoulder, reassured him with a goofy smile due to his lack of front teeth, and said, "Remember, Will, no matter what, we'll still be friends. My bet is we both get some kind of leader thing, so we'll still get to hang out even if we have different jobs." Will's name was called. Alan gave him a hug goodbye, and now Will was being led down a hall. Doors opened, and he was instructed to sit in a chair while assistants buckled him in, strapping his forearm palm side up to a table on his right. a doctor came in and praised him for how far along Will had come in his studies. Congratulated him on the great honor he was about to receive, the doctor motioned for him to take a seat and place his arm on the table in front of them. Then, with a smile from the doctor, the cutting began, and the burning and the screaming, the metallic odor of fresh blood, followed by the stink of seared flesh, all polished up, with the staff on top, covering the wound like a bow to a present. It was agony. All Will wanted to do was hold his injured arm, remove it even, anything to escape the horrible pain he felt after augmentation. That was no doctor, thought Will. No regard for others, no stake in their work, just a bone saw. They weren't healing people. The bastard didn't even give me anesthetic. In the immediate days following his assignment, Will had become uncharacteristically timid. He had always harbored a hint of distrust towards his educators, but they had never physically harmed him until now. Will's small quirks and games of observance, his hours spent wondering why they were made to read one book as opposed to another, began to develop into a dangerous paranoia. A book was no longer just a book. It was a step towards indoctrinating him in the caste. Every piece of media he consumed, another neural pathway being strengthened, another new idea to burrow deep into his mind, to hide and grow. A meal, no longer nourishment, but a venue for drug delivery and possible further unwanted, painful modifications. He attempted to isolate himself and wallow in his new distrust of authority. He wanted to shut down the flow of information, to be allowed to just exist and respond to stimuli deliberately instead of reactively. But his peers refused to let one of their own flounder. As Will reflected, his memories came back piecemeal. A hand outstretched, a friendly smile. It frustrated him that he couldn't remember the name of the first of his cohort that ventured out to break his self-imposed isolation. Was it Sean, Shirley, Steve? No, that can't be it. While he couldn't remember their name or picture their face, the words he received that day rang vividly in his ears, as if they were being spoken to him right now. Hey, Will, I'm sorry this sucks. We're all hurting too. Some more, some less. I'm sorry you're hurting so bad right now, but I don't think the educators really care how bad we hurt. This distrust you're feeling, we all get it every now and then. What matters now is how you deal with it. Are you going to sit there and do nothing? Let the sadness grow? I don't think they'd keep us. To them, you might as well be dead. Why not give trying something a chance? I can sure as heck tell you doing nothing will get you nothing, and I aim to get something when I get out of here. What do you want to get? Will smirked, remembering the words. It was incredible that someone so early in their training could dispense such wise advice. Without drugs or force, this person was able to elevate Will to the challenge at hand. Will remembered taking his new friend's hand, standing up and smiling back. What followed, Will remembered as odd. This helper looked him square in the eyes and held up their forearm, displaying their healing caste symbol. Will followed suit, displaying his own. They exchanged a moment of silent understanding, as if to say, I see your pain, and I feel it too. They hugged, despite the throbbing pain in their forearms, and walked together out of Will's room and over to find their classmates. Will shook his head, pulling himself out of nostalgia, and looked back to the shelf with the assorted kits. It didn't really matter which one was picked, but he had a favorite, aisle 3, row 4, column 2. It was a fairly unassuming piece of equipment, a 2-inch wide, 3-inch long, and 1-inch thick metal block with the national flag on the top side and a small hole midway in the wide side. However, as unassuming as it was, this little thing was useful in the right hands, a wrist-mounted toolkit. Multifunctional, albeit restricted, according to the user's life symbol. Will secured the wrist strap on his tattooed side, signaling the device to dig in, and began the synchronization process. A small drill burrowed into his forearm and hooked itself down, locking the kit in place. An exchange of fluid, followed by a happy ding and gentle vibration, let him know the synchronization was complete. William now had access to a complete surgery set. Depending on the scenario, the kit could range from covering basic first aid to a complex, multi-bypass organ reconstruction. Granted, for the more complex surgeries, he would need an equipped facility to sync into and interface with as well. Will always marveled at the device. Anything he could possibly need on the job instantly materialized in his hand. He couldn't even begin to understand how it truly worked. He knew it used some type of solid hologram-inducing technology, harmonizing particles in the air and making them rigid, manipulating them into any shape needed via device resonance parameters. He had no idea what kind of power source it used as well, but was grateful that it never appeared to need charging. The only catch, thought Will, was that he could only synthesize the expected tools for his profession. Will wondered if anyone ever tried to modify their kits and unlock more tools. The engineer Cast knows how it really works, he mused, but his high expectations were fleeting. He disappointedly remembered his peers and how they would consistently consult their own kits for step-by-step instructions on the simplest of procedures. Will began to feel dejected as his thoughts wandered. Who knows, maybe they don't know. Maybe their symbol just unlocks the schematics of everything invented and displays it for them. There really hardly is any information you truly know anymore. Will tried to explore these feelings that were stirring within him and think how people in the past would have done things, when suddenly he felt a foreign compulsion to look on the bright side. Like a catchy tune embedded in his head, he felt obligated to think of how much better off he was from past civilizations, how those people probably couldn't even figure out how to wear this fantastic equipment, box side down and hole side facing the palm. Then the realization hit him like a ton of bricks. His mind was just invaded. He was forced to think well of the nation at the cost of his own true thoughts. Will closed his eyes, took a deep breath, and counted backwards. He wasn't about to let himself turn into another blindly accepting drone. He thought, logically, to break his conditioning in an attempt to organize the social structure in his mind. He sought to intellectualize it and create distance, allowing himself to see it and interact without being swallowed whole as a part of it. He pushed each thought into his head, searching for meaning, attempting to establish the why of the things that happened. Will found that knowing why was as close to free as he had ever felt. From birth, fate is determined. Parents resign custody for the first 10 years of life. Why? To maintain control. Placement is predetermined, based on genetic tests and an early brain scan capable of producing a projected intelligence capacity. Why the tests, then? To push them. Get them to believe that they've earned their place. Then they're were shipped off to government-mandated specialization classes. After about age 6, we're given our symbol and set on our ways for the rest of our lives. He began to think of the kit. Even in the middle of a surgery, I could use my kit to give me a step-by-step walkthrough. It's a shame. Being a doctor doesn't even take skill or tenacity anymore, just placement luck. His mind was his own again, and he headed out the room, down the hallway, and into an elevator, lost in thought. As soon as he exited, his colleagues were already in the full swing of the day and ready to welcome him in. Their energy helped to kickstart him into his workplace mask. Walking down the ward hall, he was bombarded with the usual barrage of updates and requests. Will, we need you to run a diagnostic on patient X. Will, can you have a chat with family Z? Their son is in bad shape, and you've got a special way with people. Hey, golden boy, are you coming to dinner with us tonight? Will, can you give me a second opinion on this scan? To all of which, he would always reply, of course you got it, showcasing his winning smile and a demeanor of one who could take on the world. As he walked, he flipped his hand palm side up, and a selection of charts appeared hovering in his hand. He sifted through them, finding patient X. Mr. David Harding Room. 23 Chief Complaint. Severe head and neck pain. Will rifled through the file for a few minutes while walking. He briefly looked up to read the room cue he was passing, only to notice that he had arrived. Room 23, time to start the day. Will straightened his coat, took a breath, and entered the door. Good morning, Mr. Harding. How do you feel today? William asked casually. Well, doctor, my neck feels kind of sore. I have trouble looking around, especially over to my left side, and my head just gets this killer pain in it any time I think about my job, but only when the day's over. Like, I don't try to, but my mind just kind of wanders, you know? Then I get these headaches. I've been taking my daily supplements when I get into work, but I just don't think they're doing it. Do you have anything stronger? Dave answered uneasily. Will looked him over quickly, thinking while observing his patient's complexion and caste symbol. Judging by the accumulation of visceral fat on his midsection and thick muscular arms, coupled with unsure demeanor and lost stare in his eyes as they flit from instrument to instrument in the examination room, this man was unfortunately assigned to a lower intelligence caste, just another victim of bad placement luck. Likely eats plenty of fast food and endures a highly physical job, some type of laborer without any genetic intention for leadership, no doubt. Will wished he could tell this man that his headaches were just an easy fix, solved by drinking more water and laying off the salty foods, but he'd seen these symptoms before. Will had a suspicion this man might be too smart for his caste, and the only remedy he could look forward to would be a few doses of Trenazine. Will recalled the words of their great leader, all men were created to become equal, and Trenazine is that equalizer. A medication intended to reduce cognitive function, and Will hated it. Every time he met these kinds of people, it broke his heart. He knew that the system as he had become familiarized with worked, but the feeling that there had to be a better method never left him. He knew he had to get as much information from this man as he could for the sake of his own sanity and out of respect for the person whose intelligence he would be robbing. Mr. Harding, there are certainly other options we can switch you to, but could I just ask a few questions on your background before we look at our options? William asked. Of course, replied Dave. When did you feel these symptoms start up, Mr. Harding? Said Will. Dave replied quickly. 2 weeks ago, after a big job that went bad, we lost a lot of good men. A crane caused a building collapse, and it really hurt me inside, you know. Those guys, I worked with them my whole life, they were like brothers to me. That loss got me thinking. Like, how could the machines be different? Get better, safer work output and all. I didn't want nobody to go out like my guys did, so I just let my brain wander and try to figure out ways to make stuff safer. Well, there is exactly his problem, Will thought. He surmised that prenatal rewiring and early developmental subconscious conditioning must be at war with his current conscious mind. Will lamented people were meant to be creative, to produce novel solutions to problems. However, state conditioning for the most part kept a lid on it. But with a strong enough shock, creativity could be jump-started to some extent. However, unfortunately for Dave, he wasn't strong enough to beat it outright and ended up in this mess caught between a headache and a neck pain. Will wished there was something he could do to truly help this man, but time was running out. Will now turned his gaze directly into Dave's pupils, staring, searching for the person he knew lurked within, and he noticed something, a slight glimmer. A flit of the eyes, an understanding. Mr. Harding, how do you feel the nation's daily supplements have been affecting this scheme of thinking? Will asked, practically whispering. Unfazed. Dave responded in a hushed tone. Well, you see, at first they put my mind in a cloud. It felt like I was at least 10 beers in. After taking the pills, I just didn't feel sharp anymore, like ideas just kind of stopped. So I stopped taking them, and I felt like my mind was quicker. You know, thing is, after a while I started to get angry and my mind cleared up more. I even had thoughts to... Suddenly, William felt a cold sting on his wrist just below the toolkit and flinched backward, startled. Did they hear my questions? Will was worried that they knew he was about to attempt to probe deeper than ethically allowed. Was security on their way to interrogate me about this series of questions and set me up with a friendly class in teamwork and state ethics? Will apprehensively glanced down and noticed the urgent red exclamation mark being projected and was instantly relieved that his mind was safe for now, yet the victory was bittersweet. Will knew he had lost his chance and Mr. Harding would be normal by the time he returned. If only there was something he could say, some question to ask, a way to acknowledge the great strides this patient was taking, but it was futile. Will had seen this too many times before. "I'm sorry, Mr. Harding. I've got to get into surgery. The nurse will supply you with a fresh medication that should clear things up. We'll continue this later," Will said, exiting the room, and knowing full well a continuation would serve no purpose at all. He wished he could say more, console this man in some way, but all he could manage was a wave goodbye and a smile to reassure the man of his coming fate.
"One sec, Doc. I just wanted to say thanks. I really appreciate what you're doing. You're the first person to ask me about why I started trying things different and really actually cared about what I had to say. It means a lot," Dave said earnestly, holding out his hand. Will took it and shook any time. A pang of guilt shot through his body. William made a left out the door and strode down the hall to the express elevator leading to the surgery wards, breathing slowly, trying to distance himself from the shame welling up in his chest. He accessed the terminal outside the elevator, syncing his kit with the hospital database, hoping the information on his latest patient would help to distract him. The chart title read, "Unknown male, multiple fragmentation wounds." Will voraciously delved into the chart, excited at the new interesting turn his day was taking. The guilt of his last interaction, now a distant memory, as he allowed himself to be whisked away by work. Will wondered what could have created such a patient. Home experiment gone wrong, or maybe a transport derailment, or worse, a building explosion. It'd be a busy day if that were the case. The elevator spit Will out into the prep room in no time at all. Within minutes, he was scrubbed down and entering the operating room, a bright rectangle lit by white fluorescent lights. Dead center was the patient, unconscious, lying face up on the metal table draped with sterile cloth. The assistant nurse was standing off to the side, operating various computers, diagnostic equipment, and synchronization interfaces. Like Will, she too had a wrist kit, albeit much more restricted in abilities. Will was glad to see her, a new face. Her name tag read Luna. Variety never ceased to spice up his life. Will glanced at the patient and counted 15 fragmentation wounds in total. 12 to the chest and abdomen, 2 on the upper left thigh, and 1 in the left shoulder.
"It looks like this guy was hit center mass. This wasn't an accident. It appeared as if some type of scattershot perforated this man," he noted. The patient was relatively thin, with tanned skin and dark hair. He appeared to have some kind of tattoo on his neck, which Will recognized from an educational program he had watched the previous night. An agriculture symbol was on his left forearm. Definitely an outskirter. Will concluded it was odd for someone like him to be so close to the hub, he thought. "Dr. Orson, you there?" said Nurse Luna.
"Yeah, all here, sorry about that, just taking in this wound. It's odd, by the spray pattern, this doesn't look like an accident."
"Was this caused by one of those old black powder combustion weapons?" Will asked.
"Yeah, I'll check," replied Luna, as she pulled out a tablet. "Yes, according to the scatter and burns, it says these objects are something called birdshot from a weapon called a shotgun, approximate distance of assailant 5 meters.
Interesting.
"Yes, may we begin the operation now, Dr. Orson?" asked Luna. Luna's requests hadn't even struck his radar. Why did everyone always want to get these surgeries over with so quickly? No one ever savored their work, thought Will. She missed one important detail about this shotgun weapon. It was old, and the only people who would even think of using these outdated mini-cannons were gangs and anti-tech terrorist groups. These weapons, if anyone could honestly call them that, were outdated, yes,
but very difficult to get a hold of. William wondered whose life he was saving. Luna spoke up again, this time with more command in her voice. If you feel you need more information to begin, the kit is always available to you, she added with a chiding tone. William's curiosity was piqued. This nurse had grit for a newcomer, and he respected that. Straight to the job, down to business, no fear in getting mired with the dangers of bruising a doctor's ego. Let's try a little shock and awe, thought Will. Actually, I have. Judging by the scatter and shrapnel displacement, I'd say whoever shot this guy meant business. This was no accident he wanted to kill. Because it's a gun. You can assume gang activity. Because these wounds were intentional and gang-related, and given his agricultural background, I'd say this man is probably some type of low-level laborer. Just look at his body type. Thin but toned, tanned, gaunt face, long untrimmed facial hair. He certainly isn't a manager. When I pull back his lips, I can see some definite blacking of the gums and yellowing of the teeth side effects from smoking snellbush. As for his arms, track marks and venous varicosities all over, once again, side effects from any number of unregulated substances which haven't been purified to national standards. My guess is he had a side-growing operation for illicit materials. He ended up doping too much on his own product, which got his employer angry. That anger had to go somewhere. And now he's here. Phew, those outskirts can be tough. So, ooh, due to the injuries and background, I'd say we need to look out for drugs in his system that will cause his blood pressure to bottom out on us. The arm and leg wounds appear fairly stable, no excessive bleeding. They can wait. The 8 holes, peppering his chest, will need immediate attention, though. He's not breathing bilaterally, the right side of his chest sags, a right lung injury. As for the 4 shots in the abdomen, it's in the upper right quadrant, so he's got damage to the intestines as well as liver, which is probably bleeding like hell. We'll just see about that, jeered Luna, as she started running the internal scan, proving William right on all accounts. Will could see that she was attempting to hide her surprise and had to restrain himself from bursting out in cheer. Time to finish her off with a wink and she's as good as mine, thought Will. He could feel her becoming more interested in him. But, Dr. Orson, how could you have known all that just by looking at him? The power of observation, it's really an incredible tool. You just have to hone your mind to look for the clues and, hey, you can call me Will, he replied, lightly touching her forearm. She received the gesture well, prompting him to take a full mental catalogue. Not a bad person at all. She's got me sold on first impression alone, thought William. She's beautiful, fit, blonde, curves in all the right places, and just the right amount of cleavage, not to mention that confidence she displayed just now, which is incredibly attractive. Will let a smirk out accidentally. He wasn't about to let her know any time soon that he had by chance watched a program on outskirt drug trade, prompting him to delve further into the subject and learn enough haphazard facts to help him draw his recent conclusions. Start hooking him up to the stabilizers and work on an IV growth factor delivery. We'll speed up his rate of cellular regeneration while I take care of fragment removal, he added. The two locked eyes for a brief moment and set to work. 2 hours later, Will emerged from the surgery ward, satisfied, for now, and ready to handle the remainder of his 12-hour shift. He glanced at his watch. 8 hours left. The sensation of hunger became readily apparent to him as his perception of time returned. Will set course for his next destination, a quick stop by in the cafeteria to see what kind of unholy concoction they were serving up as food before continuing with patient checkups. Before embarking, however, Will let his ego take hold and work to ensure that Luna really was impressed with him before resuming his workday. Luna, how long have you been with this facility? I know I would have remembered you if we had met before, Will asked coyly. I've been in this facility for about a year now, Mr. Power of Observation, she playfully retorted. But I was just transferred to this division a few days ago, so it's understandable, she added with a smile. But it still stands. Seems like you need to hone your skills more. Wow, she really is good. That playfulness is definitely promising. Now it's time to toss on some compliments, he thought. You handled yourself very well in there. Your user-to-apparatus interaction was near flawless. He motioned in the most suave way he could muster to prompt her for a high five. His first stage ploy was to induce as much physical contact as possible to measure interest. If she reciprocated, he was on track. If not, he was just barking up the wrong tree. She met him enthusiastically. Fantastic, Will thought to himself. Well, can't leave her high and dry. I've got to keep those questions rolling. What division were you in before your transfer? Intensive care. They mostly just had me in the post-surgery ward, so I was responsible for clean-up and physical therapy-style things. Will had noticed that they had been standing in the hallway for far too much time. You know I'm feeling pretty hungry. Would you like to continue this conversation in the cafeteria? He asked, attempting to avoid any awkwardness. Sure, I'm pretty starved myself, she said with a smile. They both headed towards the cafeteria, engrossed in conversation. End of chapter 1.